Today on Ground Cover, I'm joined by Professor Kirsten Benkendorf, the Director of Southern Cross University's National Marine Science Centre. Kirsten's work focuses on the impacts of ocean climate change and environmental contaminants on the immune health and nutritional quality of seafood species. She's also investigating the use of marine mollusks for human medicine. In today's chat, Kirsten is going to talk with us about a recent SCU research project she was involved in, which looked at the effectiveness of bioreactors in managing pesticide runoff in intensive horticulture. She was also able to set up a second project which compared the soil health in conventional and regenerative blueberry farms.
Welcome to Ground Cover, a podcast created for farmers that looks at the challenges, achievements, and future of our agriculture industry. In this series, Communications Manager for Southern Cross University's Strategic Projects Team, Rebecca Lolbeck, we'll explore different regenerative agriculture practices and the impact they have on soil health, and take a close look at the results from some of our latest applied research projects. We'll also offer practical advice that farmers can take into their own properties, helping to improve the climate resilience of regional and rural communities and improve the holistic health of our landscapes. This series of Ground Cover is proudly brought to you by the Regenerative Agriculture Alliance and Southern Cross University through funding from the Australian Government's National Land Care Program.
Thanks for joining us on Ground Cover today, Kirsten. Today, we're going to be talking about a collaborative project that you've been working on through Southern Cross University, but also with Coffs Harbour City Council and local land services. And it's been looking at the effectiveness of bioreactors in managing pesticide runoff from intensive horticulture. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Rebecca. It's a really important project, I think, because there's been a lot of concern about pesticides getting into the environment from intensive horticulture, which includes in this district a lot of blueberries, but also hothouses. So in collaboration with Coffs Harbour Council, Southern Cross University and the North Coast Local Land Services have been looking at the use of bioreactors. And initially they were building these to look at retaining or preventing nutrient runoff. And I sort of stepped up with this project to say, well, you know, let's see what happens with pesticides. Can we actually see if they can be trapped by the bioreactors and thus prevent some of that runoff into our aquatic ecosystems?
Can you tell us what a bioreactor actually is?
The bioreactor that we looked at in particular is a wood chip bioreactor, and it basically just creates this anaerobic environment, so it's like reducing the oxygen availability, and it has a special community of microorganisms in there. And part of our project was actually looking at the microorganisms in the bioreactor and in the soil where the runoff is coming from the horticulture as well. So the bioreactor is kind of like this contained environment where the water coming off the horticulture, off the greenhouses, trickles through into the bioreactor, bringing in any contaminants, the nutrients, the pesticides, etc. And then this environment with lots of wood chips, which is sort of all coated with the bacteria that can help break down things like nutrients and pesticides before it runs off.
So you're bringing in that wood chip material, adding it to the site, like it's not from the site?
It can be generated on site from any trees that, you know, may actually need to come down. For example, where this bioreactor is, it's just on the edge of the forest. It's below the hothouses and on the edge of the forest before it gets down into the creek. So if there's actually a need to remove a tree to put the bioreactor in place, then that tree could actually be chipped to create the wood chips. In this case, it appears to be more like a pine type wood chip, and that could actually be good for quality control to ensure that you've got nice clean wood chip as well.
And you treat the wood chips with a certain type of material, or how does it work exactly?
They can actually be seeded with bacterial culture that could, you know, sort of get it going, the right sort of bacteria that's good for degrading and cycling nutrients. But they will actually seed naturally with the water from the environment and stuff as well. So it is actually kind of important to keep the water running through these bioreactors to keep them active. They can dry out for a little bit, but, you know, if you get them too dry, it's going to take a while for the microorganisms to kick in and get going again. So they do like to have that wet environment.
So do the bioreactors really only work on a particular type of farm then? Like, does it need to be on a steep property like you're talking about with the blueberries and the hothouses?
I guess the lay of the land does influence how the water is captured. So it doesn't necessarily need to be such a steep site, but the idea would be to position it somewhere before it runs off into a creek or into a natural sort of ecosystem. There are alternatives to bioreactors as well, of course, depending on the shape of your land, but having a wetland type environment would also facilitate the breakdown of nutrients and things like pesticides. But where you've got a lot of runoff that's sort of coming into directed channels that may be then getting into creeks or into our river systems, that's a good position to put that bioreactor to slow down the pesticides and nutrients from getting into the environment and give the bacteria more of a chance to actually act and break things down.
On these farms, these intensive horticulture properties that you've been working on, what kind of pesticides are they using and for what reason?
Yeah, so it's actually interesting because we've been doing studies in a few different catchments, and here where we've been looking at the blueberry and the hothouse runoff on the Coffs Coast, we see the use of a lot of insecticides and quite a lot of fungicides. But when we sort of move up into catchments, you know, around the northern rivers, around the Richmond River, for example, we find a lot more herbicides being used. So it does depend on what type of crop is being grown. But what's interesting is that all of these locations, we're finding quite a mixture of different pesticides that are being used. So not just one herbicide, but several, not just one insecticide, but several different things. That does actually make it quite complicated because you're trying to catch things that are potentially water soluble, some things that are less water soluble. Some of these have a pretty short half-life, so they break down well in sunlight. Others will break down better in the water, and others will actually need the bacteria to do some of that breakdown. An interesting feature of the bioreactor that I've been looking at is that it actually has an infiltration basin on the way in. And we were actually finding that some pesticides disappear pretty quickly from the soil. Some get into the infiltration basin, which is just sort of a watery pond. And that was kind of like green and really murky looking, a lot of, you know, algae and other things growing there as well. And then some are actually getting into the bioreactor. So having sort of different environments is really helpful to help capture and degrade the different types of pesticides that they may be using.
So some of them are even not breaking down before they get to the bioreactor. So that's a good type of pesticide to use if you have to use one?
Well, we did actually have a look at the soil microbiology as well as the pesticides. And immediately below the hothouse, what we find is a change in the microbial community so that it's got a lot of bacteria that are really resistant to pesticides. So that's, you know, indicating already that the soil is kind of adapting. It's not necessarily so healthy for the farm because you don't have so many bacteria that are going to be recycling nutrients that plants actually need. But there are bacteria that will sort of come in and start that degradation already. It does depend on the amount of rainfall and the amount of water that's going through the system and how water soluble those pesticides are. So we saw some really disappear very quickly in front of the hothouses, and then they weren't in the bioreactor, but they were in the creek further down. And that's just indicating that they're water soluble. They're just moving through the system too fast. But yes, certainly others will be caught, and sunlight can break down some quite effectively as well. So I do think it's pretty important to do the research on the different types of pesticides in terms of understanding environmental impacts as well as impacts to the user themselves, because some of these things are quite toxic. But understanding that the half-life and what sort of environment that they break down in, whether they break down in sunlight, whether they're water soluble, all of those sorts of factors will influence how much they might potentially impact the environment.
What about all the rainfall that we had last year? Did that impact the research at all? Because it was pretty wet.
Really high levels of rainfall can potentially move a lot of soil. This correlation between the turbidity of the water and the concentrations of the pesticides in the water. So as more soil particles are moving into our aquatic systems, we will be bringing pesticides in with that as well. And of course, we're also losing soil on our farms, so that's not good for anyone. It's certainly, you know, really important to be trying to do whatever we can to prevent erosion on farms, to retain good quality soil, as well as prevent those contaminants from getting into the waterway. So there's a number of reasons why we actually want to look at preventing soil erosion from farms. But heavy rainfall is certainly difficult to control some of that runoff. It's usually the first flush after it hasn't rained for a while when we get the biggest loading of pesticides come into our aquatic system. Then when it's been raining for a really long time, the soil is super saturated and we'll keep bringing in pesticides for a certain point, but then they'll just become really diluted and they'll wash out of the system. Yeah, it's kind of like it hasn't rained for a while, then there's a big rain. That's probably the period of time that's most concerning. And why, if we can keep these things, holding them up in the environment where they can break down naturally in wetlands, you know, any trapped through riparian vegetation, all of that good vegetation will help retard the movement of pesticides through the environment.
So if we're seeing like traces of these pesticides in the soil and in the water, are the crops actually utilizing any of these pesticides effectively, or is it not useful on farm?
It's actually a very interesting question, because there has been research, and this is not my own research, but research that's published in the peer-reviewed literature, that indicates that perhaps only as much as 5%, perhaps 3% of the pesticide that's sprayed onto plants actually sticks to the plant. And the rest is basically just running off into the environment and getting into the soil. It's a tricky one, because there has been quite a bit of research around the way pesticides are applied. And so obviously spraying something from a plane is not going to be as effective as spraying something more focused and close. But a lot more thought needs to go into the timing of the spraying, the amount that you're actually spraying. It's definitely not a case of more is better. I think it's a case of timing it quite clearly with respect to the weather, when it's not going to just wash away really quickly. It's going to actually have more effect. And then spraying that, yeah, I guess in the types of conditions where it will be uptaken by the plant, which is usually when the plant's metabolically active, there might be a little bit of moisture in the air, but it's not really raining. So they're the types of conditions that the pesticides will be more effective in as well. Not just spraying for the sake of it. Monitoring anything that you can do to increase the health of the plants. So that's all about nutrition. Healthy plants are not going to succumb to disease so easily. Naturally, we've got this sort of interaction between stress, disease, and the environment. And an organism usually only becomes sick when there's a combination of the host being weak and the disease being present. And the weakness of the host depends on the optimal environment that they're in. So if you put a lot more effort into encouraging a really healthy environment, you keep the balance a little bit better, and the host is much stronger and able to resist these diseases. So we shouldn't need as much fungicide if we've got perfect environmental conditions.
Hmm. In terms of this research project, did you have kind of any expectations of the effectiveness of a bioreactor? Had you done any kind of work on this in this space before?
I'd only been previously looking at the impacts of the pesticides on aquatic organisms. But having done a little bit of microbiology in my background, I did actually expect that the pesticides may change the microbial communities in the soil, which we definitely found evidence of. Whether they'd effectively break them down, I didn't know until we did the study, but I would have expected that there could be some variation with some pesticides being retained and others getting through, and that really was exactly what we found. And yes, certainly one of the biggest concerns in terms of the pesticides is the neonicotinoid insecticide imidacloprid, which is commonly sprayed. It's a concern for bees and other such things, but it actually seems to be very water soluble and move into our aquatic ecosystems quite easily. It does have pretty nasty effects on prawns and other such things as well, so quite a concern for our seafood. We have done some studies on our seafood looking at different types of neonicotinoids, and there is one acetomacropid, which is actually a newer, same type, but it didn't have any effect on the prawns whatsoever. So it's just one of those examples where it does make a difference what insecticide that you're actually looking at. It wasn't uptaken by the prawns as easily. It doesn't move through the environment as easily. So yeah, a lot of those newer pesticides, there's been actually quite a bit more research put into them. And I think compared to those older pesticides where the regulations weren't as strict when they actually, you know, became available on the market, it's sometimes worth paying a little bit more for a high quality insecticide that you perhaps don't need to apply as much of, and apply it a little bit more strategically, and yeah, really doing that research into which are the most beneficial pesticides to use and the timing that's most optimal for the crops that you're actually growing.
So maybe there's some work to do there in education and getting farmers aware of what types, if they have to use a pesticide, the different types that they should be using.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think that there's a lot of need to improve education around mechanisms to reduce reliance on pesticides, and then which type of pesticides, how to apply them, and all of those types of things. Because, yeah, you do sometimes see that there are people in there spraying and they're not necessarily even wearing all the protective gear, which means that they don't necessarily know the potential harmful effects to themselves, let alone to the environment. And yeah, there's certainly quite a lot of research around those higher incidence of all sorts of neurological diseases and cancers and other such things associated with heavy use of pesticides in farming communities. So it really is a concern for first and foremost the farmers, let alone the environmental effects that we see.
Are there any regulations around the use of pesticides on farm? I mean, do you have to contain them to your property, or what are the rules there for farmers?
There certainly are rules with respect to pesticides not polluting the environment. So you can be fined if the pesticides do run off your property into the environment above acceptable limits. Pesticides actually have to be registered for use. A particular industry may apply to register a particular type of pesticide for use, and that's necessary. And then the farmer itself has to have a license to use the pesticides on site. There is a little bit of regulation around that. Unfortunately, I think the legislation could be a little bit tighter around use near waterways. That would be appropriate. And I think there's a lot of need for review of some of these older types of pesticides. That some of the pesticides I was mentioning before, imidacloprid, the neonicotinoid pesticide, that's actually banned for use throughout the European Union and throughout Canada from the type of intensive horticultural use that we're seeing it used for here in Australia. We also picked up carbazamine, Benamil, quite a range of pesticides that actually are banned in other countries and sometimes even in Australia. Even though pesticides may be banned, farmers may have had them on their property, you know, in storage for a long time, and they just keep using them. So even if they're not commercially available anymore, they may still be some use. There are regulations out there that control the use of pesticides, but again, I think it comes down to education and awareness about the legislation does sometimes change, but do the farmers know about that? Are there any implications for them if they're actually still storing and using those things? Often it's quite difficult to trace pollution in the environment back to the original source as well. There's a fair bit of work to be done in this space.
And I guess often the impacts aren't as visible. I mean, you're doing tests with special equipment to see these impacts, but to the average person downstream, perhaps you wouldn't notice that that was happening upstream. And incentives for farmers perhaps to take up these new pesticides that are better holistically for the region.
Yeah, definitely. I think incentives for mitigating runoff as well as actually protecting the reefs. There are programs up in Queensland which are really around reef credits, helping farmers transition away from pesticide use or reducing pesticide runoff into the environment by providing reef credits. I think a lot of those incentives actually have to come from the consumer as well, because it's quite alarming, but it's been an awful long time in Australia since they've done a really comprehensive test of pesticide residues in all of the foods that we eat. But last time that it was done by the government, the report was pretty much buried, but it was quite surprising the high level of pesticides and the number of different pesticides. So what we're finding that there can be multiple pesticides in a single food. At the moment we regulate as if there's only one, but there's a combination. I actually think consumers should be concerned about this. I grow my own vegetables. I encourage everyone to grow their own vegetables, or you know, shop at the farmers markets and actually ask them if they use chemicals or not, because whether or not they're registered as organic, some do actually farm in a way that uses minimum pesticide. Ultimately, to incentivize farmers to change, it really comes back to the community understanding and wanting the types of foods that have been produced in more organic or chemical-free farming methods.
Absolutely. I think there's definitely a move towards the consumer making those demands of their growers. So I think we'll see more of that going forward for sure. Back to the research though, in terms of a bioreactor, is it even feasible for farmers to put them on their property? I mean, is it a large structure? How does a farmer go about putting one on their property if they need to use pesticides, they need to for productivity and for the crop's health? Can someone just go out and build a bioreactor on their property?
Yeah, well, I would certainly be looking at getting advice from council. At the moment, it is a little bit at an experimental phase, and they are trialling a few different types of bioreactor designs. And I think it's probably quite important to have a bit of a site assessment to make sure that it is positioned in an area that's going to have the most beneficial effect, and looking at the alternatives as well. Certainly, land shouldn't be excavated more than a metre in depth without council permission anyway, so that's a development if you're going to do a big excavation. I'd probably approach it more from the perspective of getting a little advice from council in the first place, just, you know, running it past them to make sure that you're not impacting other features of the environment. You don't want to be removing a significant tree to put in a bioreactor because you're having a different type of environmental effect. And I do think that there's excellent people in Coffs Council, for example, which really could provide a little bit of advice before you get stuck in and do something. That aside, you know, it's just a bit of excavation, a little bit of gravel and wood chip. The bioreactor that I tested actually did get impacted by the floods. So the council is now looking at some designs which might actually be more resilient in those strong weather conditions. Yeah, it's still a little bit of a work in progress, but it's an important space to keep an eye on. And it is actually something that is used overseas in association with hothouse. You do see in some areas of intensive horticulture, these bioreactors used often in a landscape network with wetlands and other such things that are trying to trap and retain a lot of that nutrient and pesticide runoff. So look at the whole landscape of the farm and just have an understanding of where the water might be running off, where it might be getting into the environment, if that is actually the best solution. If it's channeling down into one particular area before it runs off into the environment, it may be a good spot for a bioreactor.
And so from the research, I mean, what's your view on, is a bioreactor the most effective solution, or could it be used in conjunction with other solutions, or is there something altogether different that you think would be better in these kind of intensive horticulture situations?
I certainly think that it's just part of the solutions. As you were indicating before, incentivizing farmers and providing those incentives to transition away from pesticide use, minimizing the pesticide use, using it not in windy weather or just before rain, those types of things really will make a difference. And generally trying to replant waterways, so a lot of vegetation, riparian vegetation or vegetation along the waterways, all of those sorts of things will really help. It's not the whole solution. We want to maintain good productivity on farms, there's no doubt about that. There are many ways that you can do that. So rather than spraying in between rows, making the rows actually wide enough that you can mow and then actually using that mulch to provide organic matter back into the rows. I was working on a blueberry farm from Austenville up around that north coast sort of area. They weren't completely organic, so they did still use some pesticide, but they absolutely minimised the amount that they were using. And they were really bringing a lot of mulch and putting that organic matter back into the soil in the rows and just generating really healthy plants that way. They'd prepared the soil well, and they had excellent soil microbiology, so really high nutrient levels and really good communities of diverse microorganisms. There were pathogens that were at a low level in the soil, as you will always find, because they're ubiquitous in the environment, particularly some fungal pathogens, but they weren't causing a problem in the plant. That was really encouraging to see as part of that broader research project. I also visited some blueberry farms where they were actually trialling the use of tunnels, which they were finding were resulting in healthier blueberry crops in winter, so they didn't need to use as much fungicide because of the environmental conditions that was actually providing inside these big, they weren't completely closed tunnels, but allowing air to still move through appropriately and positioning them such that they get the right levels of sun and air movement. All of those sorts of things can make a big difference with amount of, you know, disease resistance and amount of pesticides that you might need to use.
Yeah, and in terms of growing blueberries, are these ones that are grown in the ground or are these ones in pots, or does it not really matter?
Yeah, it's interesting. The really healthy farm that I saw were grown in the ground. They were using mulch and adding that. The ones that are grown in pots, that actually does generate quite a lot of runoff. They're putting a lot more nutrient through and losing a lot more because it's just not retained as well as it would be in a soil type environment. And of course, at the end of the crop life, you're generating quite a bit of waste there with the plastic pot type material. My preference is to make your soil nice and healthy. It's a less wasteful way. I think if there is good strategies towards recycling a lot of that material that's grown in that pot type method, maybe it would be okay. But at the moment, I think there isn't a solution, an easy solution for that waste. And even just the soil and the root material in those pots, it could be contaminated with the pesticides as well. So, you know, how are they actually dealing with that? There is potential to compost a lot of that on site. And again, using bacteria could actually facilitate that process to get it back to a healthy state. 100% for improving the soil microbiology, improving the nutrients in the soil, and that will give you good, healthy plants.
It all comes back to soil, doesn't it, Kirsten?
It usually comes back to the soil.
Yeah. Is there anything from the project that kind of surprised you, or like when you're looking through your results and you thought, oh, did not expect to see that?
The biggest surprise probably was working on that blueberry farm. It was sort of a two-stage project because we did look at a farm where the bioreactor isn't, but more just generally looking at the soil microbiology in a farm that uses more of these regenerative type practices. And when they first set up the farm, they set up areas which used biochar and compost, and they had some rows with just biochar, some rows with just compost, and then some rows with the mixture, and then control with none. And we were sampling this soil 10 years after they set up the soil that way, and what was really fascinating was that the rows with the compost and the biochar actually had some higher levels of nutrients. After all this time, 10 years later, something about the way that soil was prepared with the biochar and compost combination enabled it to retain much higher levels of nutrients. So I found that really interesting because I think it really did talk to the importance of preparing the soil well when you first set up that farm and how long lasting that effect can be if you then maintain good practices. So, you know, since then, obviously, they fertilize, they mulch, you know, all of that stuff still going on, but we could still see that difference 10 years later from that initial preparation with the combination.
Was it having an impact on the yield at all?
The DPI actually set up that experimental study, and they did a study a couple of years when the blueberries first started yielding. And at those times, they were definitely getting higher yields with the blueberries that had been composted and treated with biochar. In our study, which is like another 5 years on, 10 years later, we didn't look at the yields of the blueberries specifically, but they were managing the whole farm, you know, at that point pretty similarly. And I do think that they were getting pretty good yields across the farm generally. So it was a healthy farm.
So maybe there's some more work to do in that space.
Yeah, definitely. We also had a look at an area where they'd abandoned some old blueberries that used to be grown under the plastic. They'd do sort of runs of plastic to keep the weeds down. An area that they'd used legume crops to try and regenerate the soil. And they were kind of moving back towards normal, but you could still see a depletion in the soil under the plastic mat. But admittedly, they hadn't been continuously fertilised like these other ones that were still actively being harvested. There's a lot more work to be done around the blueberries have a life. And after removing those crops, how do you actually best replenish the soil after? There's a fair bit of work that could be done around that, regenerating the soil back to those optimal conditions to get your next crop through as well.
Do you have any ideas of how a farmer could do that?
The green manure crops are a really good idea because they will bring back the nutrients into the soil. It is a good idea to have a different type of crop in between moving to your next crop of blueberries as well, because you don't want to move straight from one old crop to a new crop of the same species with the risk of the pathogens that could be in the soil. So the green manure and or even just letting it go fallow for a while, back to grass for a while, that will just rebalance the microorganisms back in the soil, help those you know, any residual pesticides and other such things break down and bring back those healthy communities of bacteria. And then good compost that's created on site, mulch, and perhaps even using some of these biochar type things that can be produced from old plant matter on the farm as well, to replenish some of those really good minerals in the soil and create that good structure. The green manure and or fallow, and switching to a different type of crop, and then preparing the soil well before you get going again, is probably the best advice I could offer.
Yeah, get back to the soil and getting your soil right and starting again.
Yep.
Yep. Great. Excellent. So in terms of the research, and you, it was a three-year project, wasn't it, with the bioreactors? And so from that, you've written a paper for a journal?
Yes, so we've got a publication that's just in final stages of preparation that we will be sending to a journal, which is looking at the soil microbial communities and the pesticides from the hothouses right through the bioreactor, and looking at the changes in the microbial profiles, you know, demonstrating that there is, you know, a whole bunch of really functional microorganisms in the bioreactor, which we used a process which is called metagenomic sequencing. So we were sequencing like the whole genome of the microbial community in these bioreactors. And we could actually show that there were a lot of types of bacteria that are quite important in degrading pesticides that are present, but also that, you know, these are anaerobic type bacteria that are also breaking down cellulose and other such things associated with that wood chip bioreactor environment. We will be publishing that paper. I think it's really important to demonstrate that bioreactors can break down some of the pesticides and help some of that runoff from getting into the environment. And we'll also be looking at a second paper that's potentially going to come out of that other study on the other blueberry farm, looking at those initial preparations of the biochar and compost and how that affects the soil microbial communities. Definitely hoping to get some scientific publications out of the work.
You mentioned earlier that the bioreactors in this research were at an experimental stage, and that the council and local land services were looking at other kind of models. Are these the only bioreactors around, or is it quite a new thing for this region to have them?
I think it's fairly new for this particular region, looking at the use of bioreactors specifically to capture the runoff from intensive horticulture. As I indicated, that actually is used in some places overseas, but in this area, I'm not so aware of people using them before this project that started with the North Coast Local Land Services and Coffs Harbour City Council to investigate. The Department of Primary Industry also is doing an experimental bioreactor up in the Woolloongabba TAFE, where they set up like an equivalent of a blueberry hothouse, but they'll know what's being sprayed at any one period of time. So they'll actually be able to sample through into that bioreactor, and they'll have an experimental wetland as well. That will be a really good experimental system to have a look, and that may also facilitate the investigation of different bioreactor designs. Yeah, they're not sort of widespread on farms at the moment.
Perhaps going forward, there may be more. It may come at a more council or DPI level at problem areas and setting them up where there are issues or known issues near waterways.
Yeah, but I do think that there will be the opportunity for farmers to approach council and say, look, I'd like to do something here. At the end of the day, I guess there is a pretty high level of community concern about pesticides, high levels of nutrients that are running off intensive horticulture into the environment. There have been a number of fines from the Environmental Protection Agency already. With the level of community concern, there will be, you know, ongoing investigations by the EPA, and any farmers that recognise that their layout, their design may result in runoff into waterways, particularly with the increasing number of hothouses going in. They do actually use a lot of pesticides in hothouses to grow cucumbers, tomatoes, other such things like that. Whenever they're near a waterway, the landowner really should be thinking about, well, am I potentially generating this sort of runoff into the environment? And if so, what can I do about it? And increasingly, it would make sense for them to perhaps approach council for that advice on whether it would be appropriate for them to install a bioreactor as well.
I mean, pesticides can't be cheap either. So, I mean, spraying them around, if there's other ways to manage pests and, like you say, just getting your soil right and having a healthy crop maybe will save you money as well.
Yeah, I should think so. It's probably not one of the main driving factors in the costs, because they're used fairly dilutely. They are active at pretty low concentrations, and considering how damaging they can be to the environment. They're perhaps a bit too cheap. But there needs to also be consideration of the broader costs to both human health in terms of those people using them and the environment. So there are a number of costs that are beyond, I think, the simple obvious economic costs, but they can be longer term costs, particularly to health, which is quite concerning. That definitely should provide an incentive for farmers to consider alternative methods for farming.
Definitely. Is there anything else, Kirsten, that you wanted to mention from the study or from the work you're doing or the work you hope to do following on from this?
I guess just to highlight that it is quite concerning from that regulatory perspective that we do see multiple different pesticides getting into the environment, sometimes getting into our seafood. We've found up to 11 different types of pesticides in oysters in the Richmond River, for example. It is a concern from that perspective that we're only regulating single pesticides, you know, as if they occur in isolation. There's a whole bunch of compounds that pesticides are mixed with, surfactants and things that also can be having endocrine disrupting type activity. So we call them estrogen-like molecules or things that can actually result in feminization. They can result in fish populations being all female, but they can also have, again, effects on humans. And glyphosate is one example of a chemical where people were testing previously and the tests weren't very good, but increasingly with the improvement in the technology, we can detect these things, and often they're detected in every single sample that we test for now. Atrazine, I'm finding all over the place. It's a herbicide and I'm finding it in so many different water bodies. So I don't think most people are really aware of how ubiquitous some of these things are becoming in the environment, and things that we thought broke down quickly, like glyphosate, well, perhaps they don't break down as quickly as we thought they did. It's just that we couldn't test for them very well in the past. But with increasing technology, I think we are able to find these things. That means that there needs to be more accountability for, you know, who's using them and how they're actually getting into the environment. And again, encourage the farmers to think about transitioning sooner rather than later, because it could be harder to get away with in the future, thinking about your health, because you can't see these things. That means that you can tend to be a little bit more complacent about it. But these are dangerous chemicals. Something that kills a pest can actually have an effect on humans at a sublethal concentration. So it mightn't necessarily kill us at the same concentration, but it's affecting our cells, and it can certainly be having all sorts of different impacts on our sensitive endocrine system, our hormones and those sorts of things. So it's a really important issue that generally want to increase awareness about, encourage good practice through what you do as well, including eating good food. Try to eat organically whenever you can.
Consumers are becoming more aware of the use of pesticides and different chemicals on their food, and they don't want it. And I think there will be that demand, and farmers doing the right thing will be rewarded.
Yeah, definitely hope so.
Well, we'll come to your farm, will we, Kirsten, and eat your veggies.
Well, I usually produce more than I need, but I certainly get a lot of, I've only got a suburban backyard, but I can pretty much eat out of it every night. So yeah, it's amazing what you can produce in your own backyard.
Excellent, excellent. Well, thanks very much for joining us on Ground Cover, Kirsten.
Hi, pleasure.
It's been lovely having you.
Thank you very much for having me, Rebecca, much appreciated.
Thanks for listening to Ground Cover. For further resources, go to farmingtogether.com.au. This series of Ground Cover is proudly brought to you by the Regenerative Agriculture Alliance and Southern Cross University through funding from the Australian Government's National Land Care Program.